I read The Magic Mountain at a susceptibly young age and wept at one of the crucial deaths in the book. Rereading it years later, that episode didn't have the same effect on me, though it still is not ineffectual. You know, I would say that all of these books have the power to surprise and have the power, though sometimes it takes a while to cast its spell upon the reader, to change the way you see the world.
It's Shelf Life. On this episode, Edwin Frank, the founder of New York Review Books, on the life of the 20th century novel as surveyed in his hefty tome, Stranger Than Fiction. A century of books distilled into 32 classics, including Rudyard Kipling's Kim, published in 1901. We discuss why it deserves a reprieve from Kipling's posthumous reputation for imperialism and jingoism. Stay with us.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. President Trump is threatening violence against Iran and says its proxies must stop causing trouble in Lebanon. The threat comes as Vice President J.D. Vance negotiates a fragile peace plan with Iran in Switzerland. NPR's Luke Garrett reports.
Trump says U.S. forces will, quote, hit Iran very hard again if its proxies keep up the fighting in Lebanon. Earlier this week, Trump had called on Israel to, quote, calm down. He pushed for a ceasefire between Iranian-backed Hezbollah and Israeli forces in southern Lebanon. This ongoing conflict threatens the recent U.S.-Iran peace plan. Meanwhile, Vice President Vance is seeking to build upon a recently signed memorandum of understanding between Iran and the U.S. He spoke Sunday from Switzerland.
The question before us now is how much more can we accomplish together? Can we turn over a new leaf? Can we change relations in the Middle East permanently?
Vance says his goals are to end Iran's nuclear program and keep the Strait of Hormuz open. Saturday, Iran said the strait was closed, but U.S. Central Command denied this. Luke Garrett, NPR News, the White House.
Colombians are voting today in a presidential runoff election. According to polls, the front runner is a far-right political newcomer who's been endorsed by President Trump and has promised to crack down on crime. John Otis reports from Bogota.
Abelardo de la Espreya is a criminal defense lawyer who has never before held political office. But his campaign has picked up steam thanks to his pledges to end peace talks with drug trafficking guerrillas and launch a military offensive. If elected, de la Espreya said in this TV interview, I will give the order to bomb all of the camps holding narco-terrorists. His opponent is Ivan Cepeda, a left-wing senator from the ruling party who has promised to reduce violence through negotiations with the rebels. Colombia's outgoing president, Gustavo Petro, is banned by the Constitution from seeking a second term. For NPR News, I'm John Otis in Bogota, Colombia.
California Governor Gavin Newsom has declared a state of emergency for Los Angeles County because of a warehouse fire. Fire Chief James Moore says fighting the blaze has become more complicated.
Initially, it was reported to us that the majority of that product was bread and wheat products. However, we're slowly learning as we start getting into this building that it is far from that. There's a lot of meat products in there, chicken, fish, poultry, pork, and beef. That's going to start to spoil. So that's going to create a hazard in itself.
County officials say two shelters have been set up for people nearby. Moore said so far there haven't been any injuries among firefighters or the public. This is NPR News in Washington. The longest day of the year and the official start of the season is today. The summer solstice occurs at the moment the Earth is at its maximum tilt toward the sun in the Northern Hemisphere. NPR's Amy Held reports.
Cultures for millennia have marked the summer solstice. In China, the Dragon Boat Festival is keeping up 2,000 years of tradition rooted to harmony with nature. Then there are stone circles. They appear to be one way Neolithic people tracked the sun during the solstice. Best known is Stonehenge in England. Now, archaeologist Phil Harding says they've dug up a 5,000-year-old structure that may have preceded nearby Stonehenge and served as its prototype.
You bet your life on it. There was feasting, there were celebrations.
Still today, thousands attend Stonehenge, more log on to a live stream. And elsewhere, there's a Midnight Sun Festival in Fairbanks, Alaska, and perhaps the Zen Yin to the New Year's Eve Yang, yoga at Times Square in New York. Amy Held, NPR News.
Rail authorities in France are urging vulnerable travelers not to take the train during the heat wave. They say the high temperatures could deform railroad tracks and damage overhead electrical lines. This week, Britain's King Charles will make public what he pays in taxes. Buckingham Palace says this is part of efforts to become more accountable and transparent. The king is not obliged to pay income tax, capital gain tax, or inheritance tax on what he received from Queen Elizabeth, but he voluntarily pays income and capital gains tax when he sells private assets. The palace says he'll release information Thursday. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
I read The Magic Mountain at a susceptibly young age and wept at one of the crucial deaths in the book. Rereading it years later, that episode didn't have the same effect on me, though it still is not ineffectual. You know, I would say that all of these books have the power to surprise and have the power, though sometimes it takes a while to cast its spell upon the reader, to change the way you see the world.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. Hello. Have you ever found yourself rummaging through a rack of used vinyl records, marveling at random discoveries, titles you'd never heard of, or classics that you'd forgotten and suddenly want back in your life again? That's the experience that Edwin Frank wanted to create for book readers. And it's the impetus behind the celebrated publishing imprint New York Review Books, founded in 1999. At my bookstore, One Gram Books, where titles are selected by celebrated bibliophiles, there is hardly a shelf that does not contain an NYRB title, whether it's C.V. Wedgwood's The 30 Years War, chosen by Ta-Nehisi Coates, in the Freud Archives by Janet Malcolm, chosen by Mike White, or Balzac's The Lily in the Valley, chosen for us by Francois Ozon. I grew up between the pages of novels, and the better part of my adult life has been spent there too, Edwin Frank writes in the introduction to Stranger Than Fiction, his newly published history of the 20th century novel, in which he explores, contextualizes, and interweaves the works of over 30 authors. We'll be talking about Frank's adventures in publishing, what the 20th century novel can still teach us, and why the derided imperialist Rudyard Kipling deserves a second opinion. Edwin, welcome to Shelf Life.
Great to be here.
Edwin, you run one of the most admired publishing houses in America, New York Review Books. More than most Americans, you must think deeply about literature on a daily basis. I wonder, what is the mark of a good read for you? What are you looking for when you open a cover of a book?
Well, I suppose, like anybody, I want to be interested and absorbed and apprised. I may be more somewhat unusually attentive to just the cast and the pace of sentences. I at one point said that I felt like the sentence was the touchstone which identified whether I thought a book was worthy of reprinting if it happened to have gone out of print. But, you know, I think that was a bit of an affectation. Sometimes there are wonderful sentences, but of course books can have wonderful, surprising plots. Any aspect or dimension of the book can be reimagined by a great writer. And when you find that moment where suddenly the book makes you look again at the world around you and look and marvel at the book itself, then it's a book you want to go on with.
Mm. Yeah, I'm guessing a lot of murder mysteries might not have particularly beautiful sentences, but they understand plot very well, and that is also a marker of a good read for many of us, I assume.
I don't know my murder mysteries very well, but I've grown up among people who are all addicted to them. And recently I've been reading a lot of P.D. James, I guess, to make up for lost time and enjoying and finding them quite wonderful.
You've obviously read a lot of books. Could you take a guess at how many you've read in your life? Are we talking about thousands, tens of thousands?
Oh, I don't really know. It's interesting. I've never even thought about that. I have a big library, and like most big libraries, people say to you, have you read all these books? And the answer is, of course, absolutely not. And I used to feel vaguely, not ashamed, but defensive perhaps about that. And but more recently, and actually in the course of writing this book, I realized that as you proceed through life and get older, and as you've read more books and even reread some books, a library is a very useful thing because, you know, you're certainly not going to read all those books, but you know where to go to find out certain kinds of things or to sample certain kinds of things and taste them. And that sort of dipping in is also very much part of a reader's life, it seems to me.
Hmm. I wonder how many books you have at any one time on your bedside table.
Too many.
Snap. As I said in the introduction, you launched NYRB in 1999, which is 25 years ago. What was your first book and how did you come to choose it?
Well, the first book in the series, which had a brief incarnation where all the books were numbered, was a reprint of a selection that Edmund Wilson had made of the later Chekhov stories, really novellas, even verging on a novel in one case, the case of the long story, 3 years, which Wilson wanted to make a case was more about politics, more about social problems than Chekhov's earlier shorter stories, and certainly than his earliest stories, which are sort of jokes. Part of the reason for doing that was to suggest the idea of reconsidering what the contribution of the past is, to nod to the role of Anchor Books as the first trade paperback imprint in America, to nod to the role of Edmund Wilson as a great critic who was addressing himself to the general reader, the curious reader, the interested reader. So those were some of the reasons for starting with that book.
One of your most notable successes was republishing John Williams' novel, Stoner, a novel about a hardworking academic who marries badly, is estranged from his child, and dies forgotten and pretty much a failure. On the surface, it doesn't sound like the most engaging read. It happens to be one of my favorite books. It sold about 2,000 copies when it was originally published in 1965. What prompted you to reissue it in 2006?
Well, it's a very, very, it simply is a very moving book and has now, not only has it done well for us, but it's done even better for publishers abroad. It's sometimes a bit of a puzzle why it should be so popular in France, in China. And I think some of that is that the book has something of the kind of long-shadowed, lonely, existential atmosphere that you find in Edward Hopper's paintings, which perhaps people who are not American find even more romantic, for lack of a better word, than Americans do. It's perhaps for Americans that's a bit ordinary. I have to say, too, though, it was fun, for me a very personal book because, in fact, he is, as you say, an academic. He's a medievalist. And so was my mother. He is at the University of Missouri, which is where, as it happened, my parents were when they met. They then moved to the University of Colorado. And I knew the sort of people when I was a little boy, people who had spent their lives studying Chaucer, but probably had never gone, who had grown up in Oklahoma and never gone to England. So there was a way in which this sort of mid-century America, kind of isolated America and isolated academy, for me, had a personal resonance.
Mm. I wonder if we can stay with that a moment. Your mother was a medievalist. That suggests a pretty sort of heady childhood surrounded by books and learning. Was it a childhood in which books were very prominent?
It was. My parents had a lot of books. So I grew up surrounded by them. I can't say I was all that interested when I was really a little boy. But then we went away when I was six. My mother had a Fulbright. We went to Paris for a year and I was put in a French school. I didn't speak a word of French. And reading became a lifesaver, a lifeline at that point.
And what were the books you were reading in France? What was the lifeline composed of?
Well, I was very into castles and things like that, of which there were plenty in France. There hadn't been any back in Colorado. So I was given a kid's version of the Iliad and Odyssey for Christmas that year. And I loved that. And then also a little later in the next year, I came back from school and my grandmother had come to stay with us and she was reading The Lord of the Rings. And I was completely besotted with Gandalf and the whole thing.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with Edwin Frank. He's the author of Stranger Than Fiction, Lives of the 20th Century Novel. Edwin, you were listening to Radiohead when the idea for your new book, Stranger Than Fiction, came to you. Can you join the dots for us between Radiohead and a book that traces the history of the 20th century novel?
Well, I was doing the dishes and listening to, you know, whatever CD happened to be lying around the kitchen. But listening to Radiohead put me in mind of the New Yorker classical music critic, though not limited to classical music, Alex Ross, who had done a big profile not long before that, I think, of the band, and had also just published a book called The Rest is Noise, which was a history of classical music in the 20th century, a book that had gotten a very excited reception, which was in its own right kind of surprising, because classical music of the 20th century is the kind of music that is considered the single most notoriously rebarbative of 20th century art forms. Mm-hmm. The number of us sort of putting on a Stockhausen track is probably fairly low. But Ross had done an interesting thing. He combined Stockhausen and the classical tradition in all its variety together with jazz. He wasn't really talking about pop, but there were issues about the technology of recording and things like that. But he was chiefly concerned with the relation of what seemed a very, very highbrow music with the history of the 20th century and the, you know, in many ways, traumatic history of the 20th century, which had sent many people into exile and so on. So that made me, I was sort of idly thinking, as I said, as I washed the dishes, and I thought, could you do that for the novel? And first I thought no, and then I thought for a little longer, and I thought, well, maybe yes, and maybe it would be an interesting book.
Hmm. It's subtitled Lives of the 20th Century Novel, but it begins with Dostoevsky's Notes from the Underground, which was published in 1864. Why did you choose to start there?
Well, it was one of those, you know, when you're writing a book, there's certain things that just seem like that's where to begin, and that seemed to me obviously the place to begin. And though I spent some time thinking, but, you know, it's in the 19th century, that just seemed to be a distraction. Part of the reason is that it is a book where the form of the book is certainly very new. It's a kind of monologue. It's a monologue by a maniacal monologuist whose relation to his reader, his world, the reader of the book, the author, all are in question. It's sort of a parody, and it's also sort of a prophetic book. So there was that. And then there was the fact that it emerges from, as so much of the literature of the next century would, from a society which is itself in crisis, which is searching for ways, and which writers are searching for ways to represent and make sense of that crisis. And it is, I think, partly that larger context of social disruption that leads to a form of what will prove to be a very dramatic literary innovation.
Do you think it's important to make the case for reading challenging or difficult books? I say that because many people might find Notes from the Underground challenging. I think I would. I'm thinking of Jeff Dyer, the British essayist and novelist, who said he'll go to his grave never having read The Brothers Karamazov, because no matter how many times he's tried, he cannot get through it. And to be fair, you don't make the greatest case for some of these books yourself. Thomas Mann's The Magic Mountain certainly sounds like a trial to read. What is the argument for working away at a book that might be tough to find our way through?
Well, I mean, I certainly don't want the book to be a book about, you know, come on, you got to eat your vegetables. I read the Magic Mountain at a susceptibly young age and wept at one of the crucial deaths in the book. Rereading it years later, that episode didn't have the same effect on me, though it still is not ineffectual. You know, I would say that all of these books have the power to surprise and have the power, though sometimes it takes a while to cast its spell upon the reader, to change the way you see the world and to change the way, you know, somewhat like, you know, there are movies which pass the time, movies which fill the screen with fireworks and so on, and you walk out and they fall away, or you just feel slightly exhausted and abused. But there are other movies that get under your skin, and you feel as if the world looks a little bit different, and you feel like you're carrying your body almost a little bit differently. I think these books all have that power too, that they have a kind of, they remake the way you see things. And sometimes that remaking may take some time, but none of them, I would say, is a dull book, though there's some that I sat down to read at the beginning. For example, Perec's Life, a User's Manual, that seemed like the experimental novel to beat all. But actually, I found myself spellbound in ways I find hard to remember now. But it was an absolutely absorbing book in its own right.
I'm interested in that idea of revisiting books at different stages in life. Are you a rereader? And does rereading a book give you a different perspective the second or third time?
Yeah, I mean, I am a rereader and perhaps ever more of one as time goes on. Yes, I mean, I think there are ways in which you take away from a first reading the thing that strikes you most, and then you go back to a book and find that something else strikes you. You can hardly even find the thing that so amazed you before, whereas other things will open up. You know, as I said, I didn't used to read detective fiction. I don't read a lot at this point either. And I used to say, oh, I'm not really interested in books that have solutions. I want a problem to last a lifetime. And a great book can be a kind of problem to last a lifetime, as well as a joy, too, or a surprise.
And is there a book that you've reread, revisited, where you've thought, what the hell was I thinking first time round? This is terrible.
The first time I read The Crying of Lot 49, I thought it was I stayed up all night. I thought it was a completely amazing book. And I still think it's an interesting book, but it's not a book that amazes me. I can't quite get back in the groove of whatever, of the spell that it cast for that night.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with Edwin Frank. He's the publisher of NYRB Books and the author of Stranger Than Fiction, Lives of the 20th Century Novel. We're talking about publishing and his favorite books. Edwin, we're now in the 21st century, and while the novel is obviously still with us, the status of literature is greatly diminished, something that is jarringly evident in your book, Stranger Than Fiction, since so many of the authors you write about, people like H.G. Wells and Colette and Kipling, who we're going to be talking about later, had such a tremendous impact in their time. I mean, they were celebrities of an order we can't imagine today. And for several hundred years, at least until the advent of radio, the printed word was a sort of preeminent form of cultural communication. As a publisher, how do you grapple with what seems like an increasingly anachronistic form?
Well, in a curious way, that shift, I think, has tended to benefit us in the sense that though it is true that now books cannot take for granted that they are the default form of entertainment or of information seeking that for many, many years they were, and above all, the default prestige one, though there is, you know, very good TV, great broadcasts, enormously sophisticated video games, you know, many other things for people to go to pass the time. Those people who are interested in books, and they are interested partly because books do provide their own very particular pleasures of absorption over a period of time, of being able to think and think again about what you're reading, go back to flip back and forth in the book. Those people who care about those things are in a way perhaps as attached as ever and concerned in some sense to keep alive a tradition that now in some ways seems threatened.
One of the aspects of publishing that is notable, I think, is that while while literature may have lost some of its sort of cultural cachet or currency, there seems to be no let up in the number of people who want to write books, who want their books published. You specialize in republishing books, books that have maybe fallen out of fashion at one point and been forgotten about, overlooked, books in translation. It's a very particular niche, but it's a niche that other publishers have begun to emulate. Perhaps you can talk a little about coming up with that concept and how you feel about being imitated by so many young pretenders.
Well, you know, I was working on a project which made me aware of how many books, this is back in the middle 90s, that I thought were pretty good books had fallen out of print. And it seemed to me that there should be an audience for. I loved them. You know, I'd loved them since I was an early reader and so on. I couldn't believe that there weren't, you know, other people who wouldn't be interested as well, because they seemed to be very lively and unusual books. We're talking about an odd array of books that we began with. I mean, the checkoff I mentioned before may sound predictable, but a number of the books on the first list were quite unpredictable. Alexander Berkman's great prison memoirs of an anarchist, one of the great American prison books. J.R. Ackerley's My Dog Tulip, one of the weirdest of animal books. Richard Hughes' High Wind in Jamaica, which is sometimes seen as a precursor to Lord of the Flies, but it's actually both funnier and crueler than Lord of the Flies, and less moralizing. So these were books that were unusual books that in some cases, like the Hughes, had actually been bestsellers in their day. And it seemed to me that there would be interest. And quite surprisingly, there was interest in the first place. And all the more surprising, perhaps, because the obvious reason why these books were not in print is they didn't make any money. But they did for us. They made a reasonable amount of money. They made enough to make the series an ongoing proposition. And so it doesn't surprise me that now there should be other, you know, other imprints doing that kind of thing. And in fact, we too are helped by a growing audience for those sorts of things.
Have you read all the books that you publish?
No, mercifully, some of them are acquired by my colleagues and are my colleagues' books. I certainly am not interested in only publishing books I like either. I mean, I really, the books that mean the most to a given reader, that a given reader likes most of all, do not constitute a canon except for that reader in a certain way. To confuse those books with the books that everybody should read or everybody should like equally would be hubris, as well as a fool's errand.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with Edwin Frank. He's the publisher of NYRB Books and the author of Stranger Than Fiction, Lives of the 20th Century Novel. Edwin, you write wonderfully of H.G. Wells, that he was, more than any other writer, the one who did most to establish a mythology of the modern. Can we talk about what that means for you and why he was so critical to the development of the 20th century novel?
Well, I think that, I mean, he's not the first author of science fiction, of course, and not even the first author of something like science fiction to be enormously popular. That would be Jules Verne. But Wells has, when he's very young and when he's very hungry for success and very angry at the world around him, a kind of visionary impatience with that world, which leads him to write science fiction that has, in some ways, the force of a page-turner, but also the force of prophecy. And he does have books that are, in the trivial sense, predictive, like, you know, a book about air warfare and things like that. But in The Time Traveler in particular, in The War of the Worlds, and in The Island of Dr. Moreau, perhaps perhaps the least read of those three at this point, though still read, he captures that sense of a world in convulsion, and he does it with a certain glee. It enables his own imagination, it enables his own success, and with a certain ruthlessness, which are part of the mood of the century: impatience with the past century, impatience for a young man from the working class, with the order of things, a demand for change, a wish for celebrity, things that will become very much part of the new world of the next century.
Mm. Perhaps we can talk a little about the platform that writers had in the early part of the 20th century. It's really kind of mind-boggling to imagine today that a writer could have the kind of stature of an H.G. Wells or indeed a Kipling. People who sold in the millions made an extraordinary amount of money from their work and were seen as prophets to some extent.
I mean, one thing that's very, very important for Wells and also for Kipling is the rise of mass literacy and also of public education of various sorts. Wells comes from such a world. Wells comes from a really very poor family indeed, and goes to the Imperial College of Science, which was not as yet called that. Doesn't do very well there, partly because he's too curious. He's too interested in politics as well. But, you know, all of that world results in a huge amount of publishing of daily papers, of books as well, and books become consumer objects. And as I say several times in the book, the form of the novel requires, it's an industrial form. It requires enough of a readership to make it worthwhile for a publisher to print such a big chunk of pages and to distribute it to the possible potential readers of that book. And Wells and Kipling arise at the moment where that really is becoming a dominant feature of the cultural landscape.
It was really extraordinary reading about Kipling to discover that in his day, his poems would appear on the front page of the New York Times. I think he published three war poems during the First World War, all of which appeared on page one of the Times. Extraordinary to imagine the Times publishing poetry on its front page today, which really does, I think, reflect the cultural import that writers, that novelists and poets were accorded then. When do you think that change began, and, you know, and how important is it to perhaps the sort of tenor of debate today that writers don't have that kind of platform, that stage, or that influence?
Well, when did it begin to change? You can look back in my childhood in the 1960s to Robert Lowell's protesting against the Vietnam War to LBJ and not coming to the White House. That was front page news. I don't think there's a poet these days who has the kind of peculiar authority that Robert Lowell had at that point. So really, it changes in the latter half of the century and increasingly. It's really in this century that the novel arrives at what is perhaps not the most ideal position for an art form of being the most prestigious form of art imaginable. Well, becoming the most prestigious form of art imaginable is very close to being something nobody wants to have anything to do with anymore, unfortunately. That moment of high esteem is in some ways the canary in the coal mine. But, you know, when I started writing Stranger Than Fiction, we'd just gone through a number of years at the beginning of this century when a number of big books in English, but not only in English, like The Corrections, then later Freedom, like Middlesex, like White Teeth or On Beauty. Also, there was David Foster Wallace. People were looking around for, and there was a sense that we needed the big novel of our new time that would sort of say where we are. And I guess I wrote this book partly in response to that, trying to think about what it was that we meant by a big novel of the times and what kinds of books had qualified as such in the past.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. My guest is Edwin Frank. He's the author of Stranger Than Fiction, Lives of the 20th Century Novel. We'll be back after this to talk about Kim by Rudyard Kipling.
Radio Catskill, keeping New York voters connected this election season. Early voting is happening now in New York State and goes through June 21st.
All registered voters in Ulster County are eligible to cast an early vote at one of three locations in Ellenville, Woodstock, and Kingston. Find your New York early voting polling place at elections.ny.gov. That's elections.ny.gov. Primary election day is June 23rd. This is Radio Catskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, what kind of inspiration should we take from the life and work of the physicist Richard Feynman?
You know, the great thing is to be endlessly curious.
And we speak with Fareed Zakaria about whether globalization is losing out to nationalism.
I think that the reports of the death of globalization are vastly exaggerated.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with Edwin Frank, publisher of NYRB and author of Stranger Than Fiction, Lives of the 20th Century Novel. We're talking about Rudyard Kipling's Kim, one of the books he singles out in Stranger Than Fiction. Edwin, in 1901, still in his 30s and 5 years shy of receiving the Nobel Prize for Literature, Rudyard Kipling published Kim, a coming-of-age novel set in British-ruled India that blends adventure, espionage, and spiritual exploration. Kim is the abbreviation for Kimball O'Hara, an orphan son of an Irish soldier who navigates the complex cultural and political landscape of India, becoming a disciple of a Tibetan Lama along the way, as well as working for a British spy working to counter Russian influence in Central Asia. I'd never read Kim until I read your essay in Stranger Than Fiction, and it's a fascinating book. I mean, I was struck by the language, by Kipling's use of dialect, and also by his kind of compassion and empathy, which I hadn't expected. Kim, in some ways, seems to anticipate many things, both the spy novel of John le Carré, you could say YA literature, just as much as Kipling's The Jungle Book, a book I have read and loved, anticipates Where the Wild Things Are. I wonder what made you choose it as one of the books seminal to the 20th century.
Well, it's a book that I liked very much when I read it, when I was pretty young. And it remains a book that is prized in India as an account and description of the Indian landscape. I was also aware of Kipling as a short story writer, one who was an innovator in the short story, one who had meant a great deal to writers you wouldn't necessarily associate with Kipling, like Jorge Luis Borges, and who was interested in the uncanny, as well as having a firm grip on reality. So with those thoughts in mind, I hadn't read Kim in a long time. I went back to it, and I thought, well, yes, this is a book that talks about something that is very much one of the things that the 20th century will grapple with, colonialism. It is something that talks about great power struggles, which are also about to erupt in a First World War a few years later. It is also a book that talks about things you wouldn't associate with those. As you said, it's in a way a kind of mystical book and a spiritual book. It is a book full of the kind of germinative contradictions and tensions that the 20th century novel will be full of, and which the author, in effect, invents a kind of new book that does all sorts of unexpected things in order to deal with those sorts of contradictions and tensions.
Hmm. Edward, you say that Kim has been recognized as a great Indian classic, popular with readers as much in India as in the West. That reminded me that Deepak Chopra, the New Age guru, has also chosen Kim as a favorite book for One Grand Books. And he makes the case that the book serves to remind us that Kipling's colonialist perspective didn't blind him to the teeming human drama of India. It's very much on the page, very much alive in Kim. But that's not the way many people think of Kipling these days. The New York Times wrote just a few years ago that it would be difficult to think of a writer as firmly out of fashion as Rudyard Kipling. I mean, was he as easy to pigeonhole as a jingoistic nationalist as posterity suggests?
No, and you mentioned before, the poems on the First World War, and it might well be assumed by our audience that these were jingoistic, militaristic poems. Kipling, who lost a son during the war, wrote some of the sharpest and most unforgiving anti-war poems in his epitaphs for the Great War. And he also had an extraordinary childhood. I mean, one of a great loneliness, having grown up in India, but being shipped back to England, where he was mistreated by a evangelical foster family, and wrote one of the great stories about basically religious abuse called Baba Black Sheep, not just religious abuse, about child abuse in the name of religion. So he was not a predictable writer.
Yeah, he had, as you suggest there, a very Dickensian childhood. And both, in a way, Dickens and Kipling wrote those childhoods into their fiction. Dickens, most famously, of course, in David Copperfield. But they were also extremely popular writers in their day. I wonder if the criticism that they've often received, Dickens for being sentimental, Kipling perhaps for being a kind of Philistine, is really nothing more than an elitist reaction to their wide popularity.
Yeah, it is true that that the 20th century, especially with ambitious novels, sees a turning away from the novel as sort of a tribune of the people in general and towards the notion of the art novel. At the beginning of my book, I contrast the achievement of the French writer André Gide, who in effect, who doesn't care at all about sales, or so he claims, and who invents in a way the template for the 20th century art novel. But frankly, those novelists also finally would like to have a readership. And they are also happy when they win the Nobel Prize, as Gide did eventually, because they would like their books to be read. And they are, I mean, and Gide, as much as Wells, is a kind of early 20th century anti-Victorian moralist. Somebody saying there's a way to live that's different from the way our parents told us to live. There's a way to write that's different from the way our parents told us. There's a way to make a novel, you know, rattle the bars of the cage or even break down the doors. And that's what we need to do.
Edwin, however true that Kipling could be jingoistic at times, if not always, the characterization is complicated by his empathy for ordinary people. You were talking there about his war poems. And what makes them significant so often is that he wrote about ordinary soldiers, those in the trenches, not the colonels or captains, certainly not the establishment, which he often loathed. I was struck by reading that it's Kipling we have to thank for the fact that all the war memorials across the United Kingdom in every village and town are ordered alphabetically and not by military rank. It's name first, rank second, which was far more radical in its time than it can possibly appear to be today. And that says something else, also complex, about Kipling, doesn't it?
I think that's very true. And I think we can say, as a poet, one of the striking things is not only does he write about ordinary people, but he writes in the vernacular. He writes in the living speech of the people, too. And this is something that makes him very influential on a Marxist writer like Brecht, that he has a kind of direct theatrical grasp of speech. And it's equally true when it comes to Kim, where, as you said, the book is full of the different languages and echoes of India. It is a language of the imagination and a language of the heart in certain ways that emerges from what he hears and what he observes. And it's also important to remember that he began as a reporter, a hardworking reporter in Lahore, reporting on local gossip, reporting on local murders, observing just the sheer range of event and accident in one of the great cities of South Asia.
He lost a son in the First World War. What do we know about how that affected him?
It devastated him. And And indeed, he's not all that productive in his later years. He dies in 39, and he retreated into a kind of bitterness, political bitterness, as well as personal bitterness. I mean, it's funny, I write about him as, in a way that I think is true, the youthful writer he was, who is in a way celebrating youth and youthful discovery and youthful energy in Kim. He became cantankerous and then wrote his own account, the quite wonderful autobiography, which he never published during his lifetime, Something of Myself, which talks about his childhood ordeal and also goes some way to explaining the investment in empire. He talks about, you know, protecting himself when he was in this terrible household with a magic circle that he would draw around himself where his imagination was free. And in a curious way, I think he saw the empire not as an imposition of the UK on the world at large, but rather as a circle where everybody could come together. I think that was a wishful and self-deceiving way of thinking about it. But I do think for him, it was a space beyond the narrowness of Little England.
He's often dismissed as a poet, but he was pretty modest about his poetry himself. Despite writing so much of it, he said, "I'm not a poet and never shall be, but only a writer who varies fiction with verse." You've written a few volumes of poetry yourself. I wonder where you rate his poetry compared to his short stories and novels.
Well, he is a serious poet, and there are not that many people who are both outstanding and innovative poets, as well as writers of the novel and the short story. I mean, in English, we have Thomas Hardy, we have Lawrence, we have Kipling. It's interesting that they all group around the early part of the century. And in a way, goes back to that moment you were talking about when the written word is perhaps at its has its greatest reach and greatest energy in addressing people. So I think I do not think he is a negligible poet, and I think to look at such powerful and verbally ingenious verse would do good for poetry in general these days.
Edwin, am I allowed to have a soft spot for Kipling's best-known poem and likely his most derided, which is If? I still get a shiver of pleasure every time I see tennis players stepping onto centre court at Wimbledon under the poem's famous lines, "If you could meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same." For me, that's just a wonderful sentiment, and frankly, a pretty healthy one. Is this just doggerel worthy of a Hallmark card, or can I hold my head high when I say I love the spirit of this poem?
It is a deeply nuanced poem, and it took me a long time. It's unfortunate that the poem simply got so adopted and so reproduced that it did seem to be a kind of the coach telling you to get ready for the big game and so on. And it was diminished to that because, in fact, it's a very thoughtful poem about what it is to win and lose and that neither comes separate from the other. It is a great poem in its way.
Edwin, I think it's fair to say that Kipling is a conundrum. How in the end do we reconcile the multiple facets of Kipling? What saves him from being dismissed as a figure hopelessly lost in the mists of empire?
Well, personally, Kipling, I think, comes off at the end as a figure of, as a rather extraordinary character. He could be a character in a novel, a figure of multiple contradictions, a figure of pathos, a limited man, as surely we are all limited people in one way or the other, who nonetheless showed a restless energy of inquiry and a desire to break through to a new place and a self-awareness even. What's interesting, that the combination of both a great self-awareness and failures of self-awareness in him are things that make him, I said, a figure of pathos, but in some ways a tragic figure. I do think as a writer, It is hard to understate the sheer range of linguistic energy and of imagination, the stories in Puck of Pook's Hill about the English landscape. He is one of the first great nature writers. That, too, is one of his accomplishments, with a profound, profound attachment to the English landscape, which he manages to make come alive. So all those things, those contradictions, as I said already, are things that make him seem to me very much a figure of the 20th century, a figure who is watching certain kinds of certainties which he clings to also fall away from the world and trying to see what kind of world we now find ourselves in.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with publisher Edwin Frank. He's just written Stranger Than Fiction, Lives of the 20th Century Novel. We're talking about Kim by Rudyard Kipling. Edwin, as you write quite beautifully in your essay on Kim, Kim is the story of an orphaned kid that looks like a kid's story, but reveals itself to be a story full of wonder and fear that asks the reader to wonder, what is this world we live in and what does it mean to live there? That's a wonderful summation of Kim. Perhaps we should play one of your favorite sections from the audiobook read here by Sam Dastor.
A little later, a marriage procession would strike into the grand trunk with music and shoutings, and a smell of marigold and jasmine stronger even than the reek of the dust. One could see the bride's litter, a blur of red and tinsel, staggering through the haze, while the bridegroom's bereaved pony turned aside to snatch a mouthful from a passing fodder cart. Then Kim would join the Kentish fire of good wishes and bad jokes, wishing the couple 100 sons and no daughters, as the saying is. Still more interesting and more to be shouted over it was when a strolling juggler with some half-trained monkeys, or a panting feeble bear, or a woman who tied goat's horns to her feet, and with these danced on a slack rope, set the horses to shying and the women to shrill, long-drawn quavers of amazement. The lama never raised his eyes. He did not note the moneylender on his goose-rumped pony, hastening along to collect the cruel interest, or the long-shouting, deep-voiced little mob, still in military formation, of native soldiers on leave, rejoicing to be rid of their breeches and puttees, and saying the most outrageous things to the most respectable women in sight. Even the seller of Ganges water he did not see, and Kim expected that he would at least buy a bottle of that precious stuff. He looked steadily at the ground, and strode as steadily, hour after hour, his soul busied elsewhere. But Kim was in the seventh heaven of joy. The grand trunk at this point was built on an embankment to guard against winter floods from the foothills, so that one walked, as it were, a little above the country, along a stately corridor, seeing all India spread out to left and right. It was beautiful to behold the many yoked grain and cotton wagons crawling over the country roads. One could hear their axles complaining a mile away, coming nearer, till with shouts and yells and bad words they climbed up the steep incline and plunged onto the hard main road, carter reviling carter. It was equally beautiful to watch the people, little clumps of red and blue and pink and white and saffron, turning aside to go to their own villages, dispersing and growing small by twos and threes across the level plain. Kim felt these things, though he could not give tongue to his feelings, and so contented himself with buying peeled sugarcane and spitting the pith generously about his path. From time to time the lama took snuff, and at last Kim could endure the silence no longer.
"This is a good land, the land of the south," said he. "The air is good, the water is good, eh?"
"And they are all bound upon the wheel," said the lama, "bound from life after life. To none of these has the way been shown." He shook himself back to this world.
"And now we have walked a weary way," said Kim. "Surely we shall soon come to a parao,"
a resting place.
"Shall we stay there? Look, the sun is sloping."
"Who will receive us this evening?"
"That is all one. This country is full of good folk. Besides, he sunk his voice beneath a whisper, we have money. The crowd thickened as they neared the resting place which marked the end of their day's journey. A line of stalls selling various simple food and tobacco, a stack of firewood, a police station, a well, a horse trough, a few trees, and under them some trampled ground dotted with the black ashes of old fires, are all that mark a parao on the Grand Trunk, if you accept the beggars and the crows, both hungry. By this time, the sun was driving broad, golden spokes through the lower branches of the mango trees. The parakeets and doves were coming home in their hundreds. The chattering, grey-backed Seven Sisters, talking over the day's adventures, walked back and forth in two and threes, almost under the feet of the travellers, and shufflings and scufflings in the branches showed that the bats were ready to go out on the night picket. Swiftly, the light gathered itself together, painted for an instant the faces and the cartwheels and the bullock's horns as red as blood. Then the night fell, changing the touch of the air, drawing a low, even haze, like a gossamer veil of blue across the face of the country, and bringing out, keen and distinct, the smell of wood smoke and cattle, and the good scent of wheaten cakes cooked on ashes. The evening patrol hurried out of the police station with important coughings and reiterated orders, and a live charcoal ball in the cup of a wayside carter's hooker glowed red, while Kim's eye mechanically watched the last flicker of the sun on the brass tweezers.
And that was a section from the audiobook of Kim, one of the books written about in Stranger Than Fiction, Lives of the 21st Century Novel, by my guest, Edwin Frank.
The pacing of that is really quite immaculate, and with both the simple sense of verbal rhythm, hard main road, Carter, reviling Carter, and then, you know, the details of color, red and blue and pink and white and saffron. Somebody who comes right out of that writing is Hemingway.
Since you mention it, can we talk a little about his influence on other writers? I mean, how do we draw a line from Kipling to Hemingway?
Well, I think really it is a matter of prose style, though it's also perhaps this coming to the more complicated issues we've been talking about, the notion of manliness, of masculinity, of adventure, of seeing the war. As I say in talking about Hemingway, who, you know, wanted to get out and see the world for what it was, to get away from the prissy platitudes of Oak Park and see the life of the big city and the life on the Italian front, as he did, and the death on the Italian front in the First World War. Kipling is among other of his qualities, somebody who is telling people all over the world, there is a world. This is a new world we live in, and it's all over the place. And people act and do different things all over that place. And to be a person, you need to go out and find out about those things. You need to be a bit of an adventurer. And as I say late in my book, there is a way in which a lot of the 20th century novel is about preserving a sense of the possibility of adventure, both for better and for worse, for going beyond the boundaries of given experience, of conventional thinking, of conventional writing, and that going beyond those boundaries in the century will lead to enormities, but will also lead to very beautiful books and great transformations, which we're very grateful to this day, too, as well.
Edwin, that's a great note on which to end. I want to thank you so much for being my guest on Shelf Life. I so enjoyed reading Stranger Than Fiction, Lives of the 20th Century Novel. I hope I'm around long enough to read Lives of the 21st Century Novel. We've been talking about Stranger Than Fiction, published by FSG, and Kim by Rudyard Kipling, published in multiple editions. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and One Grand Books in collaboration with Radio Catskill. And if you like the show, you can find plenty more on Apple and Spotify with guests such as Alan Cumming, Ari Shapiro, Joyce Maynard, and Kevin Barry. While you're there, why not give us a 5-star review? It can help others find the show.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Neversink General Store, featuring catering for parties, meetings, and weddings, gourmet deli, pizzeria, and groceries inside a gas station. NeversinkGeneralStore.com, and from listeners like you.
There's no crying in baseball, but what about magic?
We use magic in places where we don't feel like we have control. And baseball has such an element of danger and uncontrollability.
I'm Amory Sievertson. Addie Baird writes about baseball's long history of jinxes, curses, and superstition in The Magical Game. That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Every weekday morning at 9, NewsHour from the BBC brings you the most important international news stories. NewsHour helps you understand a complex world. Stay informed with NewsHour from the BBC, weekday mornings at 9 on Radio Catskill.